members have been trying to fit themselves and divide themselves into five, sixes and sevens to be at the same meeting, at all the meetings all at once. But for those members who have been able to find a space, thank you very much. And I'd like to start. This might be a long day of interaction. There are two items on the agenda for discussion, but he did in passing raise some issues related to the corporate governance framework that he would like to raise. On reflecting on his points that he made last night to me, it does seem to me that some of the issues that he's concerned about are actually legislative issues, so the issues that arise out of the Public Audit Act and aren't necessarily matters that the auditors, you know, that are in a corporate governance document that don't. And so I think if we are to discuss these matters, we do need to look as to whether the corporate governance framework reflects what is in the Public Audit Act. And if we do not like what's in the Public Audit Act, then we need to reflect on that. But I think that should be the focus of our discussion, besides any other points that people would want to raise. So with that, I would like to start with the budget and strategic plan. Firstly, I just want to know whether the Auditor General and the Deputy Auditor General, because it's really this is Mr. Makwetu's first presentation, whether he would like to say anything to the committee or can we go straight into the discussion?
Thank you very much, Chair. One thing we just probably just work out now, we're waiting for the copy slides that we are going to do for the first presentation. What we have in front of us is the second part of the presentation, which gives you the numbers on the budget, specifically the broad presentation on the financial document which was submitted is coming with the left the office for the printing as Chair.
Okay, so as I understand it, your overheads will relate to the strategic plan, is that right? And so the figures are what we've got here before us. I would like to ask members' consent. If we, as is my view, and I think that members can assist me on this, but when I look at the strategic plan, it is very much business as usual, following on what was in the annual report the previous year. Your targets are virtually the same. The whole, you know, there's not, except for possibly your expansion in personnel, there's not a huge amount of issues that we would want to spend most of the morning discussing. I would like to suggest that given that we're still waiting for these clients, that we move into the figures, and then we can go back to the strategic plan to see how these figures reflect that strategic plan and any issues arising out of that strategic plan. Could we do that?
Yeah.
Would members be happy with that approach? If we go straight into the figures? Okay. Could we then go and start then with the income statement and the take us through the... Now, I've just been briefly looking at the comparison of what we received in the first draft document to what we've received now. The figures are the same, as I understand it.
Sure, they are the same. I think if there's any difference, it's probably somewhere around 700,000. The one difference, like, so if you look at the 08-09 net number, it was 9.2 in the initial submission. And I think it's now sitting at about 8.4. Slight change.
Well, you'll show us that when we arrive at that. Okay. Could we then go into the overview of the budget itself figures?
Thank you very much, Chair. One thing I missed doing for one of our members who's attending the committee meeting for the first time is Stuart Boyd, who is our acting CFO. We've arranged that he's going to deal with the issue pertaining to the numbers and the budget to take us through that. And then I'll deal with the rest of the issue afterwards once we take on the budget. So I'll ask you to take us through the presentation of the budget.
Before we go ahead, and I know this is the chair's indulgence, and I hope you will indulge me as a chair, it's just a matter that I would want clarified about trends because it's going to constantly befog me whilst we are going through the numbers. I just want to understand how these figures are represented. If we go, and this is, let's just put it on the same page, on the page, it's 88, the old document. It's when you get to your net surplus debt, your net surplus of before capital expenditure, it's right at the end of your figures. You've got a net surplus, this is on of the old document that we've got, page 88. I'm not checking the same on this document. It's page 84 now of the new document. Your net surplus before capital expenditure is at 8.3. We're corrected. When we look at your capital expenditure, we then go into 41 million deficit. Is that right? Now, in the income statement, the capital expenditure is not reflected there. We're still working with a net surplus of 8.4 million in the projected income statement. Am I correct? Now, not being an accounting person, and given the transparency that is required for the Auditor General's office, where does it become apparent that in fact we're looking at a 41 million deficit?
Basically, the net surplus of 8.3 million is the income statement view, and the capital expenditure.
Sorry, for members, we're on page 84 of the document that you've received. If you look at in the mid page, have you received the new document? Go to the new document, and it's on page. Sorry, on page 88 of that new document. 84, sorry, 84.
The column is 2008.
Correct. Yeah. Look at the column 2008-09. That's your actual budget. When we've got a net surplus in the middle of we've got a net surplus on the left-hand side of 8.3 million, you've got that? The net surplus? Where before capital expenditure, with capital expenditure, we've got a deficit of 41 million. When you look at your projected income statement, we've got a net a record, and that's on page 78. If you go to your net income statement on page 78, we've got a net surplus budgeted of 8.4 million. Can you assist us, Mr. Boyd, just from a transparency point of view? Do you members understand? So the 8, it's recorded as the 8.1 surplus before capital expenditure, and that's reflected in the income statement.
Basically, the 8.3 million surplus is the income statement view, and that shows that our revenue less all our costs will exceed the cost by 8.3 million. Then we have planned what's called capital expenditure for 50 million rand for next year, or 50.1 million. And the two numbers, basically the capital expenditure deducted from the surplus results in a deficit of 41 million. Now, from an accounting point of view, this is merely just indicative. It doesn't mean that there's a deficit on the income statement of next year for 41 million rand. Capital expenditure is actually a balance sheet item, and as and when we incur it, we'll capitalize it on the balance sheet, and we then depreciate it over its useful life, and that those depreciation costs are included in the 8.3 million. as they come through the income statement. So the format may be a bit confusing in our eyes.
Just to add to that, Chair, what it means is that if you look at the net surplus line of 8.4, that's where the final performance measure is going to be determined. Now, if we decide that during the course of next year we are going to spend money on capital expenditure, that's really an indication of the amount of cash requirements that we will have, that we will need in order for us to meet the capital requirements in terms of assets that we want to buy. But as Stuart said, the component of that 50 million below the 8.4, the depreciation component of it is already in the income statement, because we've factored in depreciation in anticipation of spending money on those assets.
So what is the depreciation in equal? 29?
Yes, that's correct.
And so the outstanding amount outside of depreciation
is
41 million.
One has to look at the balance sheet to ascertain that information. And if you go to the page 79 of the new document, there's a projected balance sheet. And the net amount after the capital expenditure plus the balance brought forward from last year less the depreciation on last year's fixed assets equals 74.8 million. So that's the carrying value of the assets after the additional capex. If you look at the balance sheet, the projected balance sheet, you'll see there's fixed assets in budget 31 March 2009 column
for 74.8
million. So the capital expenditure at cost will be included in there, less the depreciation that's reflected in the income statement. Bear in mind that the 29 million includes depreciation on the prior year's closing balance of fixed assets as well.
Kenny?
Yeah, just to amplify it further as well, Chair. If you look at that 29 million of depreciation, that is the depreciation charge that is going to go through our income statement this year. A large portion of it is depreciation for assets that are carried forward in the beginning of 2008-09. And then of the 50 million at the bottom, there is a one-year equivalent depreciation included in the 29 million. So the 29 million is basically for assets that we already have in our books, which we know are going to depreciate this year, plus anticipated depreciation should we purchase the assets that we are putting in the CapEx line here.
Yes, I think all that is perfectly clear. What bothers me actually is more the cash flow situation. That seems to be a serious restraint, which if you look at page 80, if I understand it correctly, you have in the 31 March 2009 budget 165.7 million deficit on cash flow, which means page 80 of the new document.
Page 80 of the new document?
Yeah, that's the funding. So that is a cash flow projection, which means basically you're going to work on a 165 million overdraft, if I can put this in my own terms, which is a rather big overdraft, and obviously the problem there is your collections, how you're being paid. The question is how we actually address that situation, because your actual income, your actual expenses, and all that is 100% in balance. But the problem is there in the funding.
Chair, thank you for that, honourable member. The issue of funding, as well as the expected shortfall in funding, we did highlight it when we presented the annual report, and in the presentation that Mr. Boyd is going to do, we have done detailed analysis on the funding position. So I think when we go through this presentation, perhaps we will note some of the issues that we're highlighting, as well as the proposals that we are putting forward for how we need to address that situation. And I agree, Stephen hit it on the head when you said that the issue is really around not only the collection, but also the model that we have in place, which does not allow much flexibility with respect to funding and making sure that the funding is properly positioned. So I think in the presentation we're going to do, which is in the slides, there's also further analysis that demonstrates very clearly where the major problem is with respect to the funding. So I think we'll go through that in the democracy. Maybe we can engage in detail once we put forward the slide presentation.
Okay. I think that can give us a sense that we've got the shortfall is in the cash flow of 165 million, and the strategies of how we're going to address that.
Just to highlight something also around that chair on the 165 million. If you look at that page 80, what we've done there is presenting a very bleak picture of the funding shortfall. Because if one looks at the numbers that we've put in, we've collapsed our balance sheet basically and said the assumption is if we were to liquidate the assets that we have, as well as paying all liabilities that we have, where would we be with the current cash resources that we have? As an example, if you look at the budget line 31 March 2009, if you look at the very first line, 80.2 million, that is the liability we're carrying in our balance sheet with respect to post-retirement medical aid. That liability is a liability that is recorded in our books now, because we have entered into an obligation with our staff who are on the old rules, who, when they go on retirement, would be funded with regard to medical aid. So technically, that 80 million is not all of it payable within 1 year. It's a liability that is in our books, which is paid over the period that those people will be on retirement, for as long as that obligation is still alive. So in pulling together this funding shortfall, we are basically putting the entire 80 million into the pot as a liability that arises in the current year. The same thing with the lease liability as well. So I think there's a more accurate picture with respect to what the typical shortfall is going to be, which is 12%. So I think the 165 is probably too much on the extreme side in terms of the potential shortfall.
Mr. Stevens wants to ask a question on the 80 and the...
Yeah, thank you, Chair. That 80.2 million and the 31.6, is that a net present value of future expenditure, or is that an annual figure, an annualized figure, if all present staff had to be put on retirement or leave? Which is it, an annual figure, or is it a capital figure, that is, a net present value of future cash flows?
Specifically, the post-retirement medical aid is based on the valuation that was done at the financial year end. If you recall, there was a valuation in the annual account that was done by Alexander Ford to determine what the present value of the future medical aid liability is. Yeah. Yeah. Whereas the new liability is the liability that has been incurred on an ongoing basis. So effectively,
like we really, I wonder if the ANC members want to sit to this side. So can you see all right? Can you see that? Okay. to prefer to pick that side. Is anyone who wants to go that side? We won't regard it as crossing the floor.
We just go to page two. There's actually seven sections in the presentation I'd like to cover. The first is the purpose. I'd like to take you through a summary overview of the income statements and balance sheets. I'd like to take you through some further analysis on audit income and what's driving some of the growth there. I'd like to take you through some insights into the overhead, and I'd like to give you a summary overview of the capital expenditure, and then finally take you into the funding issue and share with you some analysis and some initial proposals in terms of the options, in terms of the way forward, and then take you to section 7 on, in terms of our thinking on the way forward. Go to page 3. This executive summary presentation of the budget components of the AG strategic plan and budget. We'd like to obtain SCOAG support for the AG budget for 2008-09. As we highlighted in the AG strategic plan and budget, the ongoing funding challenge requires completion of research and analysis into an appropriate way forward for the Auditor General and for the government in respect of cost of auditing. We'd like to obtain SCOAG support through appropriate resolutions for specific issues and risks, including the arrear debtors, tariff increases, and ongoing funding. Lastly, we'd like to understand any SCOAG concerns or requirements and action appropriately within the Auditor General. Go on to page 4. It's a rather busy slide. Let me take you through it. This is basically the income statement. You'll see there's five columns, and we start off with the actual results for the previous financial year. The next column shows our latest forecast in terms of our expected results for the year ending 31 March 2008. The third column represents the budget we require for the following financial year, and then there's a prediction in terms of the subsequent 2 years thereafter. And if we just take you through, if we can focus on forecast and the budget column, if you go down, you'll see we're forecasting a net deficit for this financial year of 16.5 million. The main reason for that is as a result of the skill shortages we continue to experience, and we have not been able to recruit the numbers of staff that we needed during the course of this year. As a result of that, the gross profit that we get from our staff is no longer there. We've had to contract that work out to the private audit firms, and in terms of our model, we do not get any contribution to overhead as a result of the private audit firms doing that work. And consequently, that's taken us into a loss position. In addition,
it's on page 4 of the document that, sorry, oh, this document here is page 4.
Okay. Please stop me if anyone is anything's unclear. And in addition to that, we've almost completed an exercise of ensuring that our balance sheet is as clean as possible. We've identified that we need to raise a provision for some 2 million rand worth of debtors, and that's quite vital. And in addition to that, we've had to increase our doubtful debt provision, primarily in respect of Eastern Cape, Northern Cape, and Northwest municipalities, by a further 8 million rand. We have also included in the forecast deficit. We've put cost reduction actions in place. We anticipate cutting back in respect of overhead to the order of about 15 million rand. We have specific actions in place to achieve that. In terms of the budget 0809, you see we're forecasting it. We budgeted a net surplus 8.4 million. I think if you just have a look at the audit income, you'll see that we budgeted 1.2 billion compared with the forecast of 1 billion for 2008. And that represents a 28% increase year on year. Now, in order to successfully deliver quality and timely audit reports, we've identified that we need to staff up accordingly, and we have a major focus on recruitment and setting up two new audit business units in order to achieve the growth in audits and achieve the net surplus of 8.4. If you have a look at our overhead expenses, the fifth row from the bottom, and you can see we're budgeting 364.9 million for 2009. And we, as part of an initiative we're running with SICA, the Institute of Chartered Accountants, we are researching and analysing tariffs and funding models. Preliminary results from that initiative indicate that the percentage of our overhead as a percentage of audit income is within international norms. In terms of, we've budgeted for a 1% surplus. We are allowed to budget up to a 3% surplus. However, our tariff tables are set up in such a way that our business executives and senior managers have a cap or a ceiling on our ability to generate gross profit from those spans of our staff. In terms of the forecast years 2010 and 2011,
can you just elaborate on that last point, the cap on the senior, in terms of the tariffs?
I've need to go through this quite slowly because it's quite complicated. It's taking myself a while to understand it.
So we can follow the explanation. Perhaps we should go to amongst that on page 107.
Yep.
That's where it will be seen. I'm
just asking for the diversion because we have to approve the audit tariffs anyway. So it might be an opportune time if things go right for us to have a look at that.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, so if you go to Annexure 3 on page 107 of the new document, you'll see there's two pages representing the proposed internal rates. First of all, if you have a look at the senior manager component of it, and you see there the highest package is 700,000 rand, at which we then determine tariffs. If you scan your eye down to the 540,000 to 559,000 rand, and then look across at the proposed tariffs for this year and for last year, you'll see it's 925 and 889. What you will note is that the tariffs, or the they all fixed at 936, despite the fact that we are paying much higher than 560,000 rand packages to those levels of staff. And this applies to most of our senior manager staff and to all of our business executives who, if not all of them, most of them earn more than 559,000 rand. The consequence of that is that our gross profit is capped. And we do not get a sufficient contribution towards our overhead as a result of that. And as a result of this capping, we are unable to actually budget a 3% surplus. The tables are set up in such a way that it's very difficult to budget beyond, you can see in this case, 0.6% as opposed to the 3.
Can I have an understanding this capping policy, where it derives from and why we are committing to it?
The historical background to this is that it has actually got no basis other than a level at which the office felt it would be too expensive for the cost of auditing to government. And chair, perhaps just to go back to last year's strategic planning session, where we did highlight that when we look at the when you look at the tariff structure for the office in the longer run, this is one area that we need to review and consider lifting those ceilings, because they actually are presenting an artificial cost of audit to government. The reason we did not do it this year is because we're still in the process of reviewing the tariffs, both for the firm as well as ourselves. So we do anticipate that next year we'll have a much more clearer basis of the cost of auditing, and it would include this measure as well.
And just to add to that, if one quantifies it, if we didn't apply that cap, there would have been an additional 79 million, so an additional 72 million that would have come into the revenue line if that cap did not apply.
That concludes page 4. Can we turn over to page 5 in terms of the balance sheet? You can see there's a similar format for the balance sheet. What you will note is that there is growth compared to the forecast 2008, and look into the year 2010-2011, you can see that the balance sheet is actually growing, and the main drivers behind that is our audit income is growing. In other words, the amount of work we're doing is growing, as well as the costs driven by our rates, which are effectively driven by our cost of our staff, and as well as our inherent business model, the way it's set up. And I understood that there was a request that we increase the special audit services fund, which you'll see under capital in the special audit services fund is kept steady at 5.3 million. I've requested that we first assess the overall funding problem and address that, because we are not generating sufficient surpluses to increase any reserves at this stage. If there are no questions, can we move on to the following page?
That's what, Chase, it's fine if I have some in between. I just want to clarify the issue pertaining to the forecast result for the 07-08 year, that's 16.5 million deficit. With regards to the write-off that we put through now, I just want to emphasize the point that those debts, what we've done is we basically have applied accounting convention to say they are so doubtful that there is no prospect of immediate recovery. But none of those have been written off. Effectively, they are still in the books. We will still continue to pursue collection. However, anything significant that would have to be written off as in we've given up would have to go through the necessary governance process. So, effectively, it's just a bookend that we put through. So those debts are still in book, we still want to pursue them, but we wanted to be more on the conservative side so that we are not called upon right at the end of the year to put through a large provision which we didn't anticipate at the time of doing the
The full doubtful debt provision is 21 million rand, and that 21 million rand relates to the municipalities in Eastern Cape, Northwest, and Northern Cape, and they have not paid their audit fees relating to the previous two financial years. That's the vast majority of that amount.
And I understand. Okay, Mr.
Gomez. I just wanted to check whether the problem is affordability or what is the problem of those municipalities.
And the feedback we got, Chair, when we did the rounds of some of the municipalities in the province is that, firstly, they say they have committed the resources that they had to prioritize the delivery project. And in some instances, we got feedback that because they did not have CFO and they were running with vacancies for a long time, there has not been proper accountability for what gets done with what was earmarked for audits. And one of the things we've requested our teams who are busy doing the MFMA now is to specifically focus on identifying what happens to those line items in the budget with respect to audit fees, so that we can at least have empirical evidence of what those funds were redirected to. So it's really on those municipalities, the combination of not having the cash because they used it on something else, as well as I think in the Eastern Cape the issue was that for as long as there was huge vacancies on CFOs, they will not even have the people who will focus on paying for audit fees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, given that this is a constitutional obligation that they should be obtained, and then it is in the interest of the state, aren't there any guarantees from the Treasury or any government body for such municipalities if initially they could not pay?
Chair, the one area we've pursued with National Treasury is to solicit their system in the effort to try and collect the cash. But certainly nothing is sitting in an account within Treasury that would be earmarked for paying for those fees. All they are doing, they are using their resources to assist us wherever they can to try and get the outstanding.
Okay. You know, this is, I think, Mr. Nomembe will concur with me. This is an ongoing story. I think ever since for the last 10 years, the Auditor General has battled to recover from local government. The National Treasury has always been said that they're going to be assisting and whatever. I see in the strategic plan you're saying that there's discussions with National Treasury on a model. Are you hopeful that these will be a little bit more fruitful than what we've had in the past?
Sure, we thought that's an avenue we need to pursue. As we speak now, there is no evidence to suggest that what we've tried before is going to be different. I guess we're still at discussion stages. We haven't actually gone out to those municipalities. The only thing we've done, which they requested us to do, is our bilateral session most recently, was for us to attempt to clean up or to attempt to do confirmations of the balances. Because every time they go out to those municipalities to try and collect on our behalf, they get told that I don't know about this amount, I don't know about this invoice, and all of those things. So it really has just become a nightmare to try and revalidate the debts that are sitting in our books. We have another meeting, I think, in a month's time with National Treasury, where we'll put our clear suggestions as to what needs to be done. I think further on in the proposal, when we talk about the funding options, I think it's on the second last point, we do deal with what we consider to be the most reasonable proposal that we can put on the table with National Treasury. And I guess Stuart will address those when he goes through some of our presentation.
Okay. is your sense that it's just going to be easier to just write off this debt, this, the entire 21 million debt?
We need the cash. The model is set up such that the income we generate covers our staff salaries and all our overheads with a very small surplus. And if we did, we can't actually afford to write off that cash. We do need assistance. We need cash. And yeah.
Have the NET for finance and local government in each of the provinces been contacted?
I've had a meeting myself personally with the Eastern Cape MET Finance, and he committed to pursuing the matter. But we've seen no, that was in August, we've seen no significant improvement in Eastern Cape arrear debtors, and the business executives responsible for the other provinces have had numerous meetings with the relevant finance functions in those areas.
Thank you, Chair. This is a wholly unacceptable situation, and it's obviously not the fault of the Auditor General's office. But it is clearly something that needs urgent attention, and he can't be beholden to people's, facilitation or non-facilitation or agreement or non-agreement. The Auditor General doesn't have a choice. He has to do it. And therefore, there can be no choice as far as the people to whom he delivers the service. They cannot either pay or not pay. They cannot simply be a bad debt. And I want to suggest, Madam Chair, that we look at the possibility of there must in one way or another come and an amendment of the MFMA and the BFMA to either create a separate account to make Treasury liable for the payment of the fees of the Auditor General, so that he doesn't have to collect it. If anybody has to collect it, let Treasury collect it, and not the Auditor General, but let the Auditor General be paid. Because it is an extremely essential service required by our constitution, required by good public management, and therefore it's totally unacceptable that is not paid. My problem is at the moment, part of the problem is that of course prescription runs against the state, so your debts that are older than 3 years are not enforceable in a court of law in any event. Although they remain payable, they are not enforceable. Which is a major problem, absolutely a major problem, unless we change something in the Act. The law must be changed. Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Machado?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the first thing is that we may be able to make views on what is being said, but I think there's a necessity for us to get probably an age analysis which could be able to tell us, is there a reputation in certain municipalities, in the certain provinces that are involved in here. And it could also give us a picture as we go forward, are we going to be experiencing one of the same things? If there was no CFO last year and there's none this year, wouldn't it be probably deliberate that we don't put this incumbent in so that we don't pay for the other shoes? But the other one is, was it in the budget? Was it budgeted for? If it was budgeted for, where did it go there? Was it used elsewhere? Those are things that we need to check. But on the other hand, I feel that something needs to be done. I know that probably it means visiting legislation, the Municipal Finance Management Act, and see whether it cannot be over-system. But the biggest one that I'm doubting is to whether do they have their own internal audit function. If they can't pay for the external audit responsibility, do they have their own internal?
Gomera.
Thanks, Chair. I think let us drop this topic by concluding that there should be a guarantor of last resort or something like that built in into this mechanism, especially of municipalities of a given characteristic. I do not know what characteristic that is, because perhaps it could be that they cannot attract people who are skilled in accounting or so because of their rural nature. Because that is what we have experienced in a town like Pongolo, where all professionals do not want to go there because there are no schools for their children, there are no facilities, and so forth. I think they may be having similar problems in these rural areas. But it doesn't mean that the Auditor General should not be paid, because it is a requirement. And therefore, there should be estimates and measures worked into the system, and then perhaps the Auditor General, the Treasury pays, the same as when banks get into trouble, the Reserve Bank. Here in this case, we have the estimate, and then it is worked every year into the budget of the Treasury. They give an account to those people, and then if Treasury is satisfied about the account that they cannot afford, then they pay. We cannot have a situation where the Auditor General is independent and self-funded, and then acting constitutionally according to the obligations and finding itself in this condition. Our role as a committee, I think we've got to include it in the report, parliamentary report, and then perhaps intervene with the finance committee as well.
We've had several suggestions here, and let me just hear from Mr. Nombembe, but I just want to also
Thank you, Chair. I just needed to add to the suggestion that has been made, and say that the Public Audit Act does make provision for the support by Treasury as and when necessary. And perhaps in building this resolution, reference can be made to that clause. It's not mandatory enough, but I think it's an option that can exercise.
Well, my researcher has drawn my attention to the clause on audit fees. And it is, I remember when we were drawing up the Municipal Finance Management Act, this was one of the big issues that concerned us. And we actually changed the constitution to allow provincial intervention or national intervention if a municipality fails to execute a statutory binding obligation. And this is clearly a statutory binding obligation. I mean, you could actually have a provincial or a national intervention on this matter, where a province could intervene and actually take over the administration of a municipality if there are other issues besides just the audit fees. Which are, I mean, for me, if you're not paying the audit fees, it's symptomatic that you're not doing anything else.
Yeah.
You know, it's the ultimate thing. And so it's really concerning me. And in the Public Audit Act, you know, there's a whole list of actions that have to be taken. You know, the National Treasury or the relevant Treasury may, after consulting the Auditor General, direct that audit fees recoverable from an auditee be defrayed from the vote on the national provincial budget identified by the relevant Treasury. The law says the National Treasury can defray an amount to be paid off. You know, I just do not understand what is going on here. And if the audit fee exceeds 1% of the total current capital expenditure of an audit team, such excess must be defrayed from the National Treasury's vote, provided that the National Treasury is of the view that the audit team has financial difficulties in setting the cost. This is a Public Audit Act. Now, what I want to know, why is National Treasury not following up on this? I mean, I remember spending hours and hours, this is section 23, 1 to 6. you know, we spent hours and hours. I mean, the Municipal Finance Management Act was the longest act in Parliament. It took us 2 years. We had to bring constitutional changes. And one of the things uppermost in our minds was this question of audit fees. And the Public Audit Act is compatible with the changes to the Constitution and with all of that. So the question I'm asking is, why is National Treasury not doing what it's obliged to do in terms of this legislation? Do we know? I'm sure you don't want to have it again and put yourself in the spot, but Mr. Nombembe?
Chatting the explanation that the DAG provided is a direction in that area to provide National Treasury with sufficient information that will make them exercise that clause of the Public Audit Act. Perhaps I would imagine, Kim, the next quarterly meeting with Treasury, we should have sufficient information now for National Treasury to begin to take a view on that matter.
Well, I think at SCOAC, I think we should request National Treasury to come before us as a committee to please explain, and with the Auditor General's office present, to please explain what their strategy is in terms of assisting the Auditor General to... I know when we sat in the Audit Commission many years ago, this issue just goes on and on and on, and I'm tired of it. So we'd be happy in asking the National Treasury to come before our committee to please explain. I would also like to just discuss, just in committee in private, just if there are any other measures, if we can link up with the hearings that the National Council of Provinces has and the Joint Budget Committee has, when they have municipalities appearing before them, whether they cannot include the question of audit fees in their regular round of questions that they... when they hold people to account. But can we make a note of that, of the possibilities of engaging with other portfolio committees and select committees here in Parliament around this issue, when they do their regular oversight work, but also with National Treasury now?
Yeah. Mr. Mwembe, the whole question of audit fees, I've never seen actually mentioned. As such, I've just overlooked it in the in every audit report that you do. Sitting on SCOPA, when we look at that, we can't really see from your report whether the audit fees are paid or are in arrears or not, or is it mentioned perhaps in audit reports that we don't see that come from municipalities and so on, but in departments, I've never seen. There's no note in your standard report saying something about audit fees, whether they have been paid or whether they are in arrears or whatever. And couldn't that perhaps be of some help, since we've now got SCOPA down to municipal level?
Well, I think that the
reason that has not been that visible is that we don't have a major problem at national and provincial level. The bulk of the challenge is at the local government level. In that case, we would only mention that if the disclosure of the liability is not properly reflected, but if they disclose that as a liability, then there will be finance in that respect. Yeah. So we will show that the annual figure of the audit fee due, and the arrears will also be shown in their balance sheet as well. But there hasn't been a comment to say to bring attention to that outstanding liability. Just it may be a good idea to draw the attention of the reader to that, yeah. Mm-hmm. As an emphasis of matter, yeah. Thanks.
Could we, in anticipation of a hearing with National Treasury, could we be given from your office, Mr. Nombembe, a document that outlines the full details of these outstanding debts? You know, not just the age analysis, but just which municipalities, how long it's been going for, and whatever. It's what Mr. Gomedi was wanting as well. So that we can then go into that. Mr. McQuaid?
We'll take note of that, Chair. I think we do have a list already that we forwarded to to National Treasury after we did the revalidation. So we'll just make sure that we provide the most up-to-date and clean one. It reflects the municipality. In fact, it's all the municipalities by province with amounts in terms of how long they've been outstanding and all that. Maybe what we can do is to update it with the most recent actions that we've attempted to do.
Why I'm very concerned if we do it fast is that the National Treasury is finalizing its budget. You know, it's in its stage of finalizing the budget for next year. And unless that's included in the budget, you're not going to get any relief from National Treasury. In fact, it would have been preferable if it had been in the adjustments estimates that were tabled yesterday. I've never saw any mention of it in the adjustments estimates, was it? No. Okay. So I think we've got to move fairly fast and targeted so that we do it before they finalize the budget. Okay. Carry on.
If you can then go to page 5.
Page 5. I think we've probably concluded page 5. We can move over to page 6. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the audit income is increasing 28% year on year, which you'll see reflected in the far right column at the bottom. And the 55% of this increase is due to the increase in hours of work, and 45% of this increase is due to effectively rate increases, which are a result of the salary increases and a general tariff increase of 4%. On the next slide, I'll cover in more detail the drivers behind the increased hours. In terms of contract work, the increase is due to our increased auditor general vacancy rate assumption. In last year's budget, we had a 5% assumption. This year, we've got an 8.3% assumption. So consequently, there's an increase there. The increase in the contract work hours is a result of similar drivers to the own hours, which we cover in the next slide. Increased pre-issuance activities. Those are where we use an independent third party to quality assure our reporting. And there's a trend that we're using more senior staff of the private audit firms than in prior years, which is driven a lot by the increase in reporting standards and auditing standards. We are busy with tariff negotiations with the private audit firms at the moment. Should be finalising this in the next month or two. Questions? Otherwise, we go to the audit hours. If you have a look, the hours have increased by 268,969 hours, contributing 156 million rand of the increase in cost of auditing. And you see there's four components here in terms of existing audits. There's a number of increases, and in terms of new audits and in terms of increased scope. The overall main drivers for the increased audit hours is driven by expanded existing audit coverage, driven by risks and scope. It's also driven by new audits that we're taking on board and by increasing performance auditing. In terms of providing capacity to be able to do this, there are an additional 2 working days in 2008-09. We've also reduced our span of control and setting up additional audit business units. And we have a very strong recruitment focus on the go. I think a question is, when do we expect the increases in audit hours to stabilize? And that's quite a difficult question to answer. But I think as we're quite dependent on both parties, the Auditor General and the government, progressing up the capability maturity model, and when we see both organisations as very mature in terms of financial management and etc., then we should see some sort of stabilisation and increase in audit hours. The Auditor General has established a new efficiency capability, and I believe it will take next financial year really to get various efficiencies identified, and I believe we'll see some efficiency improvements filtering through in the years 2010 and 2011. I don't know if the PAG would like to comment further on that.
I'm not sure if you're right. Sure, just to expand on the on the issue pertaining to the reduced span of control. Prior to commencing with the audit cycle this year, all the audit business units got together, and many of them, particularly the large ones, were feeling the pressure in terms of having large numbers of staff, but they were only one business unit. For example, we identified in the, what we did, we then conducted a review of the ideal span of control that we have in terms of how we operate. Currently sits at around 105 in total, with the different levels, obviously, senior manager down to training accountant. And in doing the analysis and the research, we picked up that four of the big business units, being amongst others, KZN, Gauteng, Western Cape, and the Eastern Cape, they were running with staff at around 180 thereabouts. Some of them close to 200. And with an ideal business unit to manage within 105, we felt that they were feeling a lot of pressure. There was difficulty for them to focus on even quality-related issues because too many people were being supervised and managed by a very small group of people. So it was decided that we need to, for those four that we identified, where there were critical issues pertaining to the size, we decided that it would make sense to split up in terms of the 08-09 budget and going forward, to split up the Eastern Cape as an example and form it into and have two distinct business units, obviously with a combination of PFMA and MFMA on it. But to say to them, you now can operate as two business units so that we can at least strive to 105 each one. So that was has happened, and in doing that, we then said there's an opportunity then to take back some of the work that we currently shift out to the private audit firms. Because in our vacancies that we spoke about, we have factored the fact that there is going to be a need to recruit to fill in the vacancies when they split into two business units. So, in essence, in those four provinces, we are in the process of establishing. And part of the recruitment process that is now undertaken is also to fill up those positions so that they run with two business units. But in essence, there's only going to be one business executive responsible for that. All we've done was basically to create an audit business unit operations leader who will, both of them, in terms of that split of two business units, will report through to the business executive. So that's one of the things that's driving the growth in our, because we've already identified that in order to make sense, not about it to make sense, by bringing in new people, we would need to have to take back somewhere so that those new people are funded directly from the fees generated. That's one of the key things that also driving the growth in the hours. Okay, sure, but, you
know. Thank you. So just concluding on page 7, if you look at the largest component, certainly that we're getting an additional 97,000 hours out of existing audit work, and if you look down, there's 45,600 hours coming out of new audits, and there's 124,000 coming out of increase in scope. So, questions? Can we move on to page 8?
Yeah, I've got one more addition which I think is important. Maybe just doing this now, because there's an arise on some of the slides in terms of the strategic plan. The other issue also taking back of new audits. One of the things that we've been getting feedback on from some of our training accountants, which also results in them not wanting to stay in the office, is the fact that their training is restricted to areas around purely the PFMA, because they have to audit government departments or they have to audit municipalities. However, in terms of Section 4.3 of the PAA, we have the option to take back some of the public entities. That would give our training accountants exposure to entities that report on generally accepted accounting practice or on international financial reporting standards. Now, the feedback we got from them is that if they don't have access to that type of training during their 3-year training program, it limits their ability and their options to explore work opportunities outside of the public sector. Or even if they wanted to stay on within either the office or move into other public sector entities. In terms of their 3-year training, they are only limited to government business without having exposure to broader accounting disciplines, which are the likes of the Rail Commuter Corporation, for example, and others. So one of the things we also put into the plan was to say, we probably need to invest time in a year or two, getting some of our senior people to position ourselves for taking back some of those audits on a gradual basis, so that it can be used also as a tool for retention of our people that come to the training scheme. Because if we can get them to get exposure to auditing those entities under our control, it will probably give them a better hope for more qualitative training that they need to be doing. So we've also got that in here. And we are very cautious that we can't go a big bang approach in terms of taking back the public entities, because there may be a need to engage with those that are charged with governance within those entities, like the audit committees, get our senior managers to attend some of the audit committees to familiarize themselves with the nature of the risks, as well as capability to be able to deal with some of the issues that they have to confront from a reporting point of view. So the 4 aspects to the taking back of work is the traditional work we do via the contract work, and as well as the work that is purely within the realm of paralegals.
Alright, we go to page 8. So the other 45% of the 28% increase is made up by the audit rate, which we discussed a little bit earlier in terms of the tariff table, and this just indicates that, highlights the point that one, you would have expected that if we put through a 4% tariff increase and we give our staff a 7% salary increase, we'd probably look at about an overall 11% increase in the tariff that we don't. We end up with an effective 9.5, and the reason for that is the way that the tariff tables are set up, and you can see in the business executive and senior manager level there's virtually no increase there as a result of the salary increases. Also, the overhead factor which we use has been kept constant. There's a 1% increase, but it's materially the same as last year. Go to the page, to page 9 on overhead. You can see our overheads overall have gone up 22%. This is largely driven by significantly increased audit activity and strategic imperatives, including amongst others, stakeholder reporting, leadership development, audit technical support, improved financial controls and systems, returning to the auditor general, performance incentives, improved technology maintenance and tools, and improving the auditor general's capability maturity, which are dealt with in quite a bit of detail in Annexure 1. What's important is, and I mentioned it earlier, is the PSYCHO research project that we're busy with, an analysis initiative. The preliminary results show that the International Supreme Audit Institution's overhead percentage of audit income ranges between 25% for the best and up to about 35%. The Auditor General is currently running at 28%, so we're slightly below the median. And it's important to bear in mind that the Supreme Audit Institution's benchmarks, the entity's benchmarks, are predominantly developed economies such as Canada, Australia, New Zealand, with mature democracies and minimal investments in transformation.
In the light of the research that's coming up at the moment, do you anticipate pressure from the auditing institutions to increase your rates?
Yes, they have expressed that they are very concerned about the low levels of historical increases in their tariffs, and have tabled their arguments with us, and we're busy with the process whereby we've asked them to do further analysis on their cost drivers and obtain that information and provide it to us in order order to provide a business case, a financial business case to substantiate additional increases in their tariff.
The question, having come from that area in the last, 6 months, do you have anything to say?
Thanks, Chair. I used to have a lot of things to say. But certainly there's no doubt, I think what Stuart indicated, I can concur with, that they had expressed the issue around our rates, that they are generally on the low side and all that. But I think the other reality also coming from the other side is that because most of the firms that we service are linked to global networks, their overhead structure, if you compare it to our own and perhaps other local accounting firms, is probably on the high side. Because, I mean, just an example, if I recall from where I've been, there were fixed costs pertaining to technology, whether you use it or you don't. The fact that it's got access to technology that's run out of New York imposes costs in the internal environment, yeah. Then the other one also they always talk about is the professional indemnity costs that they pay to their global firms in order to maintain their reputation, particularly after the Enron, WorldCom, tobacco and all that. So certainly I think even when they do the analysis of their overhead structure, we're not comparing like for like in terms of that, but there's no doubt that the pressure is mounting with regard to that. And I think it's really what's going to help, hopefully, coming out of the PSICA study, probably going to give us a better sense in terms of, you know, trying to find a middle road. But I don't think that we will be in a position to fully respond to their expectations in terms of what they expect the cost increases to be.
You know, I mean, it's the own people doing the research. You know, it's not exactly disinterested objective research. It could be seen as something disinterested research. Do you want to comment on that? If I could, yes, it's something we debated considerably before we agreed to the assignment, and unfortunately there are trade-offs, and the main one was that we required people who have access to this kind of information. They understand the industry, and they understand our business, the Auditor General business, and we felt that that those outweighed going a totally independent route. And we certainly got quite a strong governance over the project itself, and have a number of stakeholders represented in that, including, for example, IRBA and the RGA, etc., in that process. And so, yes, unfortunately, there's, we believe that it should give us the most effective result. Okay, continue on the third bullet point on the page 9. What's also important to note is there's certain new costs that have arisen in the 08-09 year, and including the performance incentive provision of 9 million. They also included one-off costs of 5.3 million for specific ICT initiatives we're running, and 3.6 million for next year's AfroSci conference, which we're hosting. If you exclude those, the year-on-year increase reduces to around about 16%. We're increasing our focus on service quality and efficiency for next year.
Just to build another layer to that 16%, you know, if you strip off those ones off issues, that 16%, a portion of it is recovered via the audit fees, because when we're talking about growing the audit fee base in terms of taking back some audits and all of that, we're getting additional revenue. So I think when you look at the year-on-year growth in terms of the, particularly pertaining to staff remuneration as well as providing the additional space, because we are also looking at finding additional buildings for people who will be moving towards the expanded capacity.
So that goes in overhead, the credit line against which it is recovered.
So in terms of the corporate services and the overhead, there's a drive and a focus around service quality and efficiencies next year, where we also earmarked money to be invested in processes. And there's a detailed analysis of all these different costs in the Annexure 1 of the budget and strategic plan. Any questions? Page 10, capital expenditure. I've really summarized this at a very high level. You can see we're planning 50.1 million versus 39 million last year. That's a 29% increase. And the largest drivers around this is that we're moving into new housing premises, and we require new furniture for those premises. And we're setting up a second campus in Brooklyn for the new audit business units, and there's not only furniture requirements, but other capital costs involved there. And what we've found in the technology space is we've certainly underinvested in the last couple of years. And you can even see in last year, we planned to spend some $5 million. We're not going to be able to spend it this year. And one of the biggest cost drivers for next year is that we've got some 40 regional servers that are out of date, and we need to refresh those as well. Once again, the annexure and the note 19 provide quite a lot more detail on this.
Just also on this one, Chair, we looked at this particularly because we felt that even though around the time we're doing the budget, there's a need for putting in new furniture in terms of the branding requirements and so on. We took a view that much as we may have it in the budget, the reality is that we would have to follow our cash flow in actually making the decision to purchase some of these. For situations where we have to move into new premises because of capacity constraints, we probably would have no choice then. But for offices where it was way back understood that there was going to be furniture replacement, we took a view that we would have to justify why we need to replace furniture. If we need to do any replacement, for example, there would be only on the basis that we are replacing something that is beyond repair. Not necessarily overhauling the image kind of thing, because we recognize the fact that we've got stringent pressures with regards to cash flow. And even though it's not an income statement item, but it hits our funds if we have to pay for new furniture, because clearly the one we have may not necessarily attract any value from a disposal point of view. So we've taken that view, and I think when we finalize the budget, it's a decision. Operationally,
it was taken afterwards. So I think we will exercise caution when we take decisions to spend money on this area.
In fact, King, I saw the Johannesburg offices are very expensive per square meter. Is that general for Johannesburg?
Yeah, I'll respond to that. Yes, if we look at, let me just look up the notes on, we've got all those tables.
Given that you've also got a CBD where it's generally recognized that it's low tariff, but this isn't in the CBD. Carry on.
Across the board, we have found that the buildings that we're moving into are higher grade buildings, and there is quite a bit of pressure on increasing the rentals and also the servicing costs around those buildings. And that is one of the factors that is driving up some of our accommodation costs. And we found that with the buildings, even in the area that we're moving into in Gauteng. I think with a lot of the focus on regenerating those areas, consequently the rentals are going up as well.
Back to
Okay, if we can move on to page 11, which is where we started this morning's discussion, is on funding. And I've I believe we've covered this information. I'd just like to highlight, if you look under the first bullet, in terms of our latest detailed forecast, we are estimating we need around about 63 million rand, which includes capital and interest, in order to meet our operating expenditure, capital expenditure, and reserve requirements for 07-08. So I think we came to the conclusion already this morning that this statement highlights the funding deficit issue, and we need to re-examine our funding model. If you go to the next page, if we could spend some time on this and understand it, what we've done here is created a...
this is your funding model that you're looking at now?
Yes.
I wonder if we shouldn't just break for tea quickly, and remember a quick break for tea, because we need to get through the business. And then if we can just go and fetch stuff and bring it back to have where we're sitting. We'll take a 5 minute comfort break.
Gracias.